Novice, explained Norbert. Who is the grave for? Asked Sir Hyle, as they resumed their climb up the wooden steps. Brother Clement, may the father judge him justly. Was he old? Asked Podrick Payne. If you consider 48 old, aye, but it was not the years that killed him. He died of wounds he got at Saltpans. He had taken some of our mead to the market there, on the day the outlaws descended on the town.
The hound? Said Brian.
Another, just as brutal. He cut poor Clement's tongue out when he would not speak. Since he had taken a vow of silence, the raider said he had no need of it. The elder brother will know more. He keeps the worst of the tidings from outside to himself, so as not to disturb the tranquillity of the septuary. Many of our brothers came here to escape the horrors of the world, not to dwell upon them. Brother Clement was not the only wounded man amongst us. Some wounds do not show. Brother Norbert gestured to their right. There lies our summer arbour. The grapes are small and tart, but make a drinkable wine. We brew our own ale as well, and our mead and cider are far famed.
The war has never come here, Brian said.
Not this war, praise the seven. Our prayers protect us.
And your tides, suggested Meribald.
Dog barked agreement. The brow of the hill was crowned by a low wall of unmortared stone, encircling a cluster of large buildings. The windmill, its sails creaking as they turned, the cloisters where the brothers slept, and the common hall where they took their meals. A wooden sept for prayer and meditation. The sept had windows of leaded glass, wide doors carved with likenesses of the mother and the father, and a seven-sided steeple with a walk on top. Behind it was a vegetable garden where some older brothers were pulling weeds. Brother Norbert led the visitors around a chestnut tree to a wooden door set in the side of the hill.
A cave with a door? Sir Hyle said, surprised.
Septon Meribald smiled. It is called the Hermit's Hall. The first holy man to find his way here lived therein, and worked such wonders that others came to join him. That was 2,000 years ago, they say. The door came somewhat later. Perhaps 2,000 years ago, the Hermit's Hole had been a damp, dark place, floored with dirt and echoing to the sounds of dripping water. But no longer. The cave that Brian and her companions entered had been turned into a warm, snug sanctum. Woolen carpets covered the ground, tapestries the walls. Tall beeswax candles gave more than ample light. The furnishings were strange but simple. A long table, a settle, a chest, several tall cases full of books and chairs. All were made from driftwood, oddly shaped pieces cunningly joined together and polished till they shone a deep gold in the candlelight. The elder brother was not what Brian had expected. He could hardly be called elder for a start, whereas the brothers, weeding in the garden, had had the stoop shoulders and bent backs of old men, he stood straight and tall and moved with the vigour of a man in the prime of his years. Nor did he have the gentle, kindly face she expected of a healer. His head was large and square, his eyes shrewd, his nose veined and red. Though he wore a tonsure, his scalp was as stubbly as his heavy jaw.
He looks more like a man made to break bones than to heal one,
thought the maid of Tarth, as the elder brother strode across the room to embrace Septon Meribald and Pat Dog.
It is always a glad day when our friends Meribald and Dog honour us with another visit, he announced, before turning to his other guests. And new faces are always welcome. We see so few of them.
Meribald performed the customary courtesies before seating himself upon the settle. Unlike Septon Norbert, the elder brother did not seem dismayed by Brian's sex, but his smile did flicker and fade when the Septon told him why she and Sir Hyle had come.
I see,
was all he said, before he turned away with, "You must be thirsty. Please have some of our sweet cider to wash the dust of travel from your throats." He poured for them himself. The cups were carved from driftwood, too. No two the same. When Brian complimented them, he said, "My lady is too kind. All we do is cut and polish the wood. We are blessed here. Where the river meets the bay, the currents and tides wrestle one against the other, and many strange and wondrous things are pushed toward us, to wash up on our shores. Driftwood is the least of it. We have found silver cups and iron pots, sacks of wool and boats of silk, rusted helms and shining swords, aye, and rubies." That interested Sir Hyle. "Rhaegar's rubies?" "It may be, who can say. The battle was long leagues from here, but the river is tireless and patient. Six have been found. We are all waiting for the seventh." "Better rubies than bones." Septon Marybold was rubbing his foot, the mud flaking off beneath his finger. "Not all the river's gifts are pleasant. The good brothers collect the dead as well. Drowned cows, drowned deer, dead pigs swollen up to half the size of horses. Aye, and corpses."
"Too many corpses these days," the elder brother sighed. "Ah, our grave digger knows no rest. Rivermen, westermen, northmen, all washed up here. Knights and knaves alike. We bury them side by side, Stark and Lannister, Blackwood and Bracken, Frey and Derry. That is the duty the river asks of us in return for all its gifts, and we do it as best we can. Sometimes we find a woman, though, or worse, a little child. Those are the cruelest gifts." He turned to Septon Marybold. "I hope that you have time to absolve us of our sins. Since the raiders slew old Septon Bennet, we have had no one to hear confession."
"I shall make time," said Marybold. "Though I hope you have some better sins than the last time I came through." Dog barked. "You see?" Even Dog was bored. Podrick Payne was puzzled.
"I thought no one could talk."
"Well, not no one. The brothers, the other brothers, not you."
"We are allowed to break silence when confessing," said the elder brother. "It is hard to speak of sin with signs and nods."
"Did they burn the sept at Salt Pans?" asked Hyle Hunt. The smile vanished.
"They burned everything at Salt Pans, save the castle.
Only that was made of stone, though it had as well been made of suet, for all the good it did the town. It failed me to treat some of the survivors. The fisherfolk brought them across the bay to me after the flames had gone out, and they deemed it safe to land. One poor woman had been raped a dozen times, and her breasts... My lady, you wear man's mail, so I shall not spare you these horrors. Her breasts had been torn and chewed and eaten, as if by some cruel beast. I did what I could for her, though that was little enough. As she lay dying, her worst curses were not for the men who had raped her, nor for the monster who devoured her living flesh, but for Sir Quincy Cox, who barred his gates when the outlaws entered the town and sat safe behind stone walls as his people screamed and died.
"Sir Quincy is an old man," said Septon Marybold gently. "His sons and good sons are far away, or dead. His grandsons are still boys, and he has two daughters. What could he have done? One man against so many?"
"He could have tried," Brian thought. "He could have died. Old or young, a true knight is sworn to protect those who are weaker than himself, or die in the attempt."
"Are true words and wise," the elder brother said to Septon Marybold. "When you cross to Salt Pans, no doubt Sir Quincy will ask you for forgiveness. I am glad that you are here to give it. I could not."
He put aside the driftwood cup and stood.
"The supper bell will sound soon. My friends, will you come with me to the sept to pray for the souls of the good folk of Salt Pans before we sit down to break bread and share some meat and mead.
Gladly, said Marybold. Dog barked. Their supper in the septory was as strange a meal as Brian had ever eaten, though not at all unpleasant. The food was plain but very good. There were loaves of crusty bread still warm from the ovens, crocks of fresh churned butter, honey from the septory's hives, and a thick stew of crabs, mussels, and at least three different kinds of fish. Septon Marybold and Sir Hyle drank the mead the brothers made and pronounced it excellent, while she and Podrick contented themselves with more sweet cider. Nor was a meal a somber one. Marybold pronounced a prayer before the food was served, and whilst the brothers ate at four long trestle tables, one of their number played for them on the high harp, filling the hall with soft, sweet sounds. When the elder brother excused the musician to take his own meal, Brother Narbot and another proctor took turns reading from the seven-pointed star. By the time the readings were completed, the last of the food had been cleared away by the novices whose task it was to serve. Most were boys near Podrick's age or younger, but there were grown men as well, amongst them the big gravedigger they had encountered on the hill, who walked with the awkward lurching gait of one half-crippled. As the hall entered, the elder brother asked Narbot to show Podrick and Sir Hyle to their pallets in the cloisters.
"You will not mind sharing a cell, I hope. It's not large, but you will find it comfortable." "I want to stay with Sir," said Podrick. I mean, my lady. What you and Lady Brian may do elsewhere is between you and the seven," said Brother Narbot. "But on the quiet isle men and women do not sleep beneath the same roof unless they are wed. And we have some modest cottages set aside for the women who visit us, be they noble ladies or common village girls," said the elder brother. "They are not oft used, but we keep them clean and dry. Lady Brian, would you allow me to show you the way?" "Yes, thank you. Podrick, go with Sir Hoyle. We are guests of the Holy Brothers here. Beneath their roof, their rules."
The women's cottages were on the east side of the isle, looking out over a broad expanse of mud and the distant waters of the Bay of Crabs. It was colder here than on the sheltered side, and wilder. The hill was steeper, and the path meandered back and forth through weeds and briars, wind-carved stones, and twisted, thorny trees that clung tenaciously to the stony hillside. The elder brother brought a lantern to light their way down. At one turn he paused.
"On a clear night you can see the fires of Salt Pans from here, across the bay, just there," he pointed. "There's nothing," Brian said. "Only the castle remains. Even the fisher folk are gone, the fortunate few who were out on the water when the raiders came. They watched their houses burn and listened to screams and cries float across the harbour, too fearful to land their boats. When at last they came ashore, it was to bury friends and kin. What is there for them at Salt Pans now but bones and bitter memories? They have moved to Maidenpool or other towns." He gestured with a lantern, and they resumed their descent. Salt Pans was never an important port, but ships did call there from time to time. That was what the raiders wanted, a galley or a cog to carry them across the narrow sea. When none was at hand, they took their rage and desperation out upon the townsfolk. I wonder, my lady, what do you hope to find there? "A girl," she told him, "a high-born maid of 3 and 10, with a fair face and auburn hair. Sansa Stark," the name was softly said. "You believe this poor child is with the hound?"
The Dornishman said that she was on her way to River Run. Timian, he was a sellsword, one of the brave companions, a killer and a raper and a lawyer. But I do not think he lied about this. He said that the hounds stole her and carried her away."
"I see." The path turned, and there were the cottages ahead of them. The elder brother had called them modest. That they were.
They looked like beehives made of stone, low and rounded, windowless. "This one," he said, indicating the nearest cottage, the only one with smoke rising from the smoke hole in the centre of the roof. Brain had to duck when entering to keep from banging her head against the lintel. Inside she found a dirt floor, a straw pallet, furs and blankets to keep her warm, a basin of water, a flagon of cider, some bread and cheese, a small fire, and two low chairs. The elder brother sat in one and put the lantern down.
May I stay a while? I feel that we should talk. If you wish.
Brain undid her sword belt and hung it from the second chair, then sat cross-legged on the pallet.
"Your adornishment did not lie,"
the elder brother began,
"but I fear you did not understand him. You are chasing the wrong wolf, my lady. Eddard Stark had two daughters. It was the other one that Sandor Clegane made off with, the younger one."
"Arya Stark?"
Brian stared, open-mouthed, astonished.
"You know this? Lady Sansa's sister is alive?"
"Then," said the elder brother, "no, I do not know. She may have been amongst the children slain at Saltpans." The words were a knife in her belly.
"No," Brian thought. "No, that would be too cruel. May have been. Meaning that you're not certain."
"I am certain that the child was with Sandor Clegane at the inn, beside the crossroads. The old one Marsha Heddle used to keep, before the lions hanged her. I am certain they were on their way to Saltpans. Beyond that, no. I do not know where she is, or even if she lives. There's one thing I do know, however. The man you hunt is dead." Oh, that was another shock.
"How did he die?"
"By the sword. As he had lived.
You know this for certainty? I buried him myself. I can tell you where his grave lies, if you wish. I covered him with stones to keep the carrion eaters from digging up his flesh, and set his helm atop the cairn to mark his final resting place. That was a grievous error. Some other wayfarer found my marker and claimed it for himself. The man who raped and killed at Saltpans was not Sandor Clegane, though he may be as dangerous. The riverlands are full of such scavengers. I will not call them wolves. Wolves are nobler than that. And so are dogs, I think. I know a little of this man, Sandor Clegane. He was Prince Joffrey's sworn shield for many a year. And even here we would hear tell of his deeds, both good and ill. If even half of what we heard was true, this was a bitter, tormented soul, a sinner who mocked both gods and men. He served, but found no pride in service. He fought, but took no joy in victory. He drank to drown his pain in a sea of wine. He did not love, nor was he loved himself. It was hate that drove him. Though he committed many sins, he never sought forgiveness. When other men dream of love or wealth or glory, this man, Sandor Clegane, dreamed of slaying his own brother. A sin so terrible, it makes me shudder just to speak of it. Yet that was the bread that nourished him, the fuel that kept his fires burning. Ignoble as it was, the hope of seeing his brother's blood upon his blade was all this sad and angry creature lived for. And even that was taken from him when Prince Oberyn of Dorne stabbed Sir Gregor with a poisoned spear. You sound as though you pity him, said Brain.
I did. You would have pitied him as well, if you had seen him at the end. I came upon him by the trident, drawn by his cries of pain. He begged me for the gift of mercy, but I am sworn not to kill again. Instead, I bathed his fevered brow with river water, and gave him wine to drink, and a poultice for his wound. But my efforts were too little and too late. The hound died there in my arms. You may have seen a big black stallion in our stables. That was his war horse, Stranger. A blasphemous name. We prefer to call him Driftwood. As he was found beside the river, I fear
He has his former master's nature.
The horse. She had seen the stallion and heard it kicking, but she had not understood. Destriers were trained to kick and bite. In war they were a weapon, like the men who rode them.
Like the hound. It is true, then, she said dully. Sangor Clegane is dead.
He is at rest. The elder brother paused. You are young, child. I have counted 44 name days, which makes me more than twice your age, I think. Would it surprise you to learn that I was once a knight?
No, you look more like a knight than you do a holy man.
It was written in his chest and shoulders, and across that thick, square jaw.
Why would you give up knighthood?
I never chose it. My father was a knight, and his before him. So were my brothers, every one. I was trained for battle since the day they deemed me old enough to hold a wooden sword. I saw my share of them, and did not disgrace myself. I had women, too. And there I did disgrace myself. For some I took by force. There was a girl I wished to marry, the younger daughter of a petty lord. But I was my father's third-born son, and had neither land nor wealth to offer her, only a sword, a horse, a shield. All in all, I was a sad man. When I was not fighting, I was drunk. My life was written red, in blood and wine.
When did it change? Asked Brian.
When I died, in the Battle of the Trident. I fought for Prince Rhaegar, though he never knew my name. I could not tell you why, save that the lord I served a lord who served a lord who had decided to support the dragon rather than the stag. Had he decided elsewise, I might have been on the other side of the river. The battle was a bloody thing. The singers would have us believe it was all Rhaegar and Robert struggling in the stream for a woman both of them claimed to love. But I assure you, other men were fighting too. And I was one. I took an arrow through the thigh, and another through the foot, and my horse was killed from under me. Yet I fought on. I can still remember how desperate I was to find another horse, for I had no coin to buy one, and without a horse I would no longer be a knight. That was all that I was thinking of, if truth be told. I never saw the blow that felled me. I heard hoofs behind my back, and thought, ah, a horse! But before I could turn, something slammed into my head and knocked me back into the river, where by rights I should have drowned. Instead, I woke up here, upon the quiet isle. The elder brother told me I had washed up on the tide, naked as my name day. I can only think that someone found me in the shallows, stripped me of my armor, boots, and breeches, and pushed me back, out into the deeper water. The river did the rest. We are all born naked, so I suppose it was only fitting that I come into my second life the same way. I spent the next 10 years in silence.
I see.
Brian did not know why he was telling her all of this, or what else she ought to say.
Do you?
He leaned forward, his big hands on his knees.
If so, give up this quest of yours. The hound is dead, and in any case, he never had your Sansa Stark. As for this beast who wears his helm, he will be found and hanged. The wars are ending, and these outlaws cannot survive the peace. Randall Tarly is hunting them from Maidenpool, and Walder Frey from the Twins. And there is a new young lord in Derry, a pious man who will surely set his lands to rights. Go home, child. You have a home, which is more than many can say in these dark days. You have a noble father who must surely love you. Consider his grief if you should never return. Perhaps he will bring your sword and shield to him after you have fallen. Perhaps he will even hang them in his hall and look on them with pride. But if you were to ask him, I know he would tell you that he would sooner have a living daughter than a shattered shield.
A daughter? Brian's eyes filled with tears. He deserves that. A daughter who could sing to him and grace his hall and bear him grandsons.
He deserves a son, too, a strong and gallant son, to bring honour to his name. Galdan drowned when I was 4, and he was 8, though, and Alisane and Ariane died still in the cradle. I am the only child the gods let him keep, the freakish one, not fit to be a son or daughter.
All of it came pouring out of Brienne then, like black blood from a wound. The betrayals and betrothals, Red Ronnet and his rose, Lord Renlier dancing with her, the wager for her maidenhead, the bitter tears she shed the night her king wed Marjorie Tyrell, the melee at Bitterbridge, the rainbow cloak that she had been so proud of, the shadow in the king's pavilion, Renly dying in her arms, Riverrun and Lady Caitlin, the voyage down the Trident, dueling Jamie in the woods, the bloody mummers, Jamie crying, sapphires, Jamie in the tub at Harrenhal, the steam rising from his body, the taste of Vargo Holt's blood when she bit down on his ear, the bear pit, Jamie leaping down onto the sand, the long ride to King's Landing, Sansa Stark, the vow she'd sworn to Jamie, the vow she'd sworn to Lady Caitlin, Oathkeeper, Duskendale, Maidenpool, Nimble Dick, and Crackclaw, and the Whispers, the men she'd killed.
"I have to find her," she finished. "There are others looking, all wanting to capture her and sell her to the Queen. I have to find her first. I promised Jamie. Oathkeeper," he named the sword. "I have to try to save her, or die in the attempt."
Cersei.
A thousand ships? The little queen's brown hair was tousled and uncombed, and the torchlight made her cheeks look flushed, as if she had just come from some man's embrace.
"Your Grace, this must be answered fiercely."
Her last word rang off the rafters and echoed through the cavernous throne room. Seated on her gold and crimson high seat beneath the iron throne, Cersei could feel a growing tightness in her neck.
"Must?" she thought. "She dares say must to me?"
She itched to slap the Tyrell girl across the face.
"She should be on her knees, begging for my help. Instead, she presumes to tell her rightful queen what she must do." "A thousand ships?"
Sir Harry Swift was wheezing.
"Surely not. No lord commands 1,000 ships."
"Some frightened fool has counted double," agreed Orton Merryweather. "That or Lord Tyrell's bannermen are lying to us, puffing up the numbers of the foe, so we will not think them lax."
The torches on the back wall threw the long barbed shadow of the Iron Throne halfway to the doors. The far end of the hall was lost in darkness, and Cersei could not but feel that the shadows were closing around her too.
"My enemies are everywhere, and my friends are useless."
She had only to glance at her counsellors to know that. Only Lord Qyburn and Orane Waters seemed awake. The others had been roused from bed by Marjorie's messengers pounding on their doors, and stood there rumpled and confused. Outside, the night was black and still. The castle and the city slept. Boris Blunt and Meryn Trant seemed to be sleeping too, albeit on their feet. Even Osmond Kettleblack was yawning. Not Loras, though. Not our Knight of Flowers. He stood behind his little sister, a pale shadow with a long sword on his hip.
"Half as many ships would be 500, my lord,"
Waters pointed out to Orton Merryweather.
"Only the arbour has enough strength at sea to oppose a fleet that size."
"What of your new Drummonds?" asked Sir Harris. "The long ships of the Iron Men cannot stand before our Drummonds, surely. King Robert's Hammer is the mightiest warship in all Westeros."
"She was," said Waters. "Sweet Cersei will be her equal once complete, and Lord Tywin will be twice the size of either. Only half are fitted out, however, and none is fully crewed. Even when they are, the numbers would be greatly against us.
The common longship is small compared to our galleys, that is true, but the Iron Men have larger ships as well. Lord Balin's great Kraken and the warships of the Iron Fleet were made for battle, not for raids. They are the equal of our lesser war galleys in speed and strength, and most are better crewed and captained. The Iron Men live their whole lives at sea.
Robert should have scoured the Isles after Balon Greyjoy rose against him, Cersei thought. He smashed their fleet, burned their towns, and broke their castles. But when he had them on their knees, he lifted them up again. He should have made another island of their skulls. That was what her father would have done. But Robert never had the stomach that a king requires, if he hopes to keep peace in the realm. The Iron Men have not dared raid the Reach since Dagon Greyjoy sat the Sea Stone chair, she said. Why would they do so now? What has emboldened them?
Their new king!
Cyburn stood with his hands hidden up his sleeves.
Lord Balon's brother, the Crow's Eye, he is called.
The carrion crows make their feasts upon the carcasses of the dead and dying, said Grand Maester Pycelle. They do not descend upon hale and healthy animals. Lord Euron will gorge himself on gold and plunder, aye, but as soon as we move against him, he will back to pike, as Lord Dagon was wont to do in his day.
You are wrong, said Margaery Tyrell. Reavers do not come in such strength. 1,000 ships. Lord Hewitt and Lord Chester are slain, as well as Lord Ceres, son and heir. Ceri has fled to Highgarden with what few ships remain him, and Lord Grimm is a prisoner in his own castle. Willis says the Iron King has raised up 4 lords of his own in their places.
Willis, Cersei thought, the cripple. He is to blame for this. That oaf, Mace Tyrell, left the defence of the Reach in the hands of a hapless weakling.
It is a long voyage from the Iron Isles to the Shields, she pointed out. How could 1,000 ships come all that way without being seen?
Willis believes that they did not follow the coast, said Margaery. They made the voyage out of sight of land, sailing far out into the sunset sea and swooping back in from the west.
More like the cripple did not have his watchtowers manned, and now he fears to have us know it. The little queen is making excuses for her brother. Cersei's mouth was dry. I need a cup of Arbor Gold. If the Iron Man decided to take the Arbor next, the whole realm might soon be going thirsty.
Stannis may have had a hand in this. Balon Greyjoy offered my lord father an alliance.
Perhaps his son has offered one to Stannis.
Pycelle frowned.
What would Lord Stannis gain by...
He gains another foothold. And plunder. That as well. Stannis needs gold to pay his sellswords. By raiding in the west, he hopes he can distract us from Dragonstone and Storm's End.
Lord Merryweather nodded.
A diversion. Stannis is more cunning than we knew. Your Grace is clever to have seen through his ploy.
Lord Stannis is striving to win the Northmen to his cause, said Pycelle. If he befriends the Ironborn, he cannot hope...
The Northmen will not have him, said Cersei,
wondering how such a learned man could be so stupid.
Lord Manderley hacked the head and hands off the Onion Knight. We have that from the phrase, and 6 other northern lords have rallied to Lord Bolton.
The enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Where else can Stannis turn? But to the Iron Men and the Wildlings, the enemies of the North. But if he thinks that I am going to walk into his trap, he's a bigger fool than you.
She turned back to the little queen.
The Shield Islands belong to the Reach. Grimm and Ceri and the rest are sworn to Highgarden. It is for Highgarden to answer this.
Highgarden shall answer, said Margaery Tyrell. Willis has sent word to Leighton Hightower in Oldtown, so he can see to his own defences. Garland is gathering men to retake the Isles. The best part of our power remains with my lord father, though. We must send word to him at Storm's End at once.
and lift the siege? Cersei did not care for Margaery's presumption.
She says at once to me. Does she take me for her handmaid?
I have no doubt that Lord Stannis would be pleased by that. Have you been listening, my lady? If he can draw our eyes away from Dragonstone and Storm's End to these rocks.
Rocks? Gasped Margaery. Did your grace say rocks?
The Knight of Flowers put a hand upon his sister's shoulder.
If it please your grace, from those rocks, the Iron Man threatened Old Town and the Arbor.
From strongholds on the shields, raiders can sail up the Mander into the very heart of the Reach, as they did of old. With enough men, they might even threaten Highgarden.
Truly? Said the Queen, all innocent.
Why, then, your brave brothers had best roust them off these rocks. And quickly.
How would the Queen suggest they accomplish that, without sufficient ships? Asked Sir Loras.
Willis and Garland can raise 10,000 men within a fortnight, and twice that in a moon's turn. But they cannot walk on water, your grace.
Highgarden sits above the Mander, Cersei reminded him. You and your vassals command 1,000 leagues of coast. Are there no fisherfolk along your shores? Do you have no pleasure barges, no ferries, no river galleys, no skiffs?
Many and more, Sir Loras admitted.
Such should be more than sufficient to carry a host across a little stretch of water, I would think.
And when the longships of the Ironborn descend upon our ragtag fleet, as it is making its way across this little stretch of water, what would your grace have us do then?
Drown? Thought Cersei. Highgarden has gold as well. You have my leave to hire sail sails from beyond the narrow seas.
Pirates out of mire and lice, you mean?
Laura said with contempt.
The scum of the free cities?
He is as insolent as his sister.
Sad to say, all of us must deal with scum from time to time, she said with poisonous sweetness. Perhaps you have a better notion.
Only the Arbor has sufficient galleys to retake the mouth of the Mander from the Iron Men and protect my brothers from their longships during the crossing. I beg your grace, send a word to Dragonstone and command Lord Redwyn to raise his sails at once.
At least he has the sense to beg.
Paxter Redwyn owned 200 warships and 5 times as many merchant carracks, wine cogs, trading galleys, and whalers. Redwyn was encamped beneath the wall of Dragonstone, however, and the greater part of his fleet was engaged in ferrying men across Blackwater Bay for the assault on that island stronghold. The remainder prowled a Shipbreaker Bay to the south, where only their presence prevented Storm's End from being resupplied by sea.
Orane Waters bristled at Sir Loras's suggestion.
If Lord Redwyn sails his ships away, how are we to supply our men on Dragonstone? Without the Arbor's galleys, how will we maintain the siege of Storm's End?
The siege can be resumed later, after Cersei cut him off.
Storm's End is 100 times more valuable than the Shields and Dragonstone. So long as Dragonstone remains in the hands of Stannis Baratheon, it is a knife at my son's throat. We will release Lord Redwyn and his fleet when the castle falls.
The Queen pushed herself to her feet.
This audience is at an end. Grand Maester Pycelle, a word.
The old man started, as if her voice had woken him from some dream of youth. But before he could answer, Loras Tyrell strode forward, so swiftly that the Queen drew back in alarm. She was about to shout for Sir Osmond to defend her when the Knight of Flowers sank to one knee.
Your Grace, let me take Dragonstone.
His sister's hand went to her mouth.
Loras, no.
Sir Loras ignored her plea.
It will take 30 days or more to starve Dragonstone into submission, as Lord Paxter means to do. Give me the command, your grace. The castle will be yours within a fortnight, if I have to tear it down with my bare hands.
No one had given Cersei such a lovely gift since Sansa Stark had run to her to divulge Lord Eddard's plans. She was pleased to see that Margaery had gone pale. "Your courage takes my breath away, Sir Loras," Cersei said. "Lord Walters, are any of the new Drummonds fit to put to sea?"
"As sweet Cersei is, Your Grace, a swift ship and as strong as a queen she's named for."
"Splendid.
Let sweet Cersei carry our Knight of Flowers to Dragonstone at once. Sir Loras, the command is yours. Swear to me that you shall not return until Dragonstone is Tommen's."
"I shall, Your Grace."
He rose. Cersei kissed him on both cheeks. She kissed his sister, too, and whispered, "You have a gallant brother." Either Margaery did not have the grace to answer, or fear had stolen all her words. Dawn was still several hours away when Cersei slipped out of the king's door behind the Iron Throne. Sir Osmond went before her with a torch, and Qyburn strolled along beside her. Pycelle had to struggle to keep up.
"If it please Your Grace," he puffed, "young men are overbold and think only of the glory of battle, and never of its dangers. Sir Loras, this plan of his is fraught with peril. To storm the very walls of Dragonstone is very brave."
"Brave, yes, but I have no doubt that our Knight of Flowers would be the first man to gain the battlements."
"And perhaps the first of all." The puck-scarred bastard that Stannis had left to hold his castle was no callow, tawny champion, but a seasoned killer. If the guards were good, he would give Sir Loras the glorious end he seemed to want. Assuming the boy does not drown on the way. There had been another storm last night, a savage one. The rain had come down in black sheets for hours. "And wouldn't that be sad?" the queen mused. "Drowning is ordinary. Sir Loras lust for glory, as real men lust for women. The least the guards can do is grant him a death worthy of a song." No matter what befell the boy on Dragonstone, however, the queen would be the winner. If Loras took the castle, Stannis would suffer a grievous blow, and the Red Wind fleet could sail off to meet the Iron Men. If he failed, she would see to it that he had the lion's share of the blame. Nothing tarnishes a hero as much as failure. And if he should come home on his shield, covered in blood and glory, Sir Osney will be there to console his grieving sister. The laugh would not be contained any longer. It burst from Cersei's lips and echoed down the hall.
"Your Grace!"
Grand Maester Pycelle blinked, his mouth sagging open.
Why would you laugh?"
"Why?" she had to say. "Elsewise I might weep. My heart is bursting with love for our Sir Loras and his valour." She left the Grand Maester on the Serpentine Steps. "That one has outlived any usefulness he ever had," the queen decided. All Pycelle ever seemed to do, of late, was plague her with cautions and objections. He had even objected to the understanding she had reached with the High Septon, gaping at her with dim and rheumy eyes when she commanded him to prepare the necessary papers and babbling about old dead history until Cersei cut him off. "King Maegor's day is gone, and so are his decrees," she said firmly. "This is King Tommen's day, and mine. I would have done better to let him perish in the black cells."
"Should Sir Loras fall, Your Grace will need another worthy for their king's guard,"
Lord Qyburn said as they crossed over the spike moat that girded Maegor's holdfast.
"Someone splendid," she agreed. "Someone so young and swift and strong that Tommen will forget all about Sir Loras. A bit of gallantry would not be amiss, but his head should not be full of foolish notions. Do you know such a man?"
"Alas, no," said Qyburn. "I had another sort of champion in mind. What he lacks in gallantry, he will give you tenfold in devotion. He will protect your son, kill your enemies, and keep your secrets, and no living man will be able to withstand him."
"So you say. Words are wind. When the hour is ripe, you may produce this paragon of yours, and we will see if he is all that you have promised.
They will sing of him, I swear it.
Lord Kyburn's eyes crinkled with amusement.
Might I ask about the armor?
I have placed your order. The armor thinks that I am mad. It assures me that no man is strong enough to move and fight in such a weight of plate. Cersei gave the chainless maester a warning look.
Play me for a fool, and you'll die screaming. You are aware of that, I trust.
Always, Your Grace.
Good. Say no more of this. The Queen is wise. These walls have ears.
So they do. At night, Cersei sometimes heard soft sounds, even in her own apartments. Mice in the walls, she would tell herself. No more than that. A candle was burning by her bedside, but the hearth fire had gone out, and there was no other light. The room was cold as well. Cersei undressed and slipped beneath the blankets, leaving her gown to puddle on the floor. Across the bed, Taina stirred.
"Your Grace," she murmured softly, "what hour is it?"
"The hour of the owl," the Queen replied. Though Cersei often slept alone, she had never liked it. Her oldest memories were of sharing a bed with Jaime, when they had still been so young that no one could tell the two of them apart. Later, after they were separated, she'd had a string of bedmaids and companions, most of them girls of an age with her, the daughters of her father's household knights and bannermen. None had pleased her, and few lasted very long.
Little sneaks, a lot of them, vapid, weepy creatures, always telling tales and trying to worm their way between me and Jaime.
Still, there had been nights deep within the black bowels of the rock when she had welcomed their warmth beside her. An empty bed was a cold bed. Here, most of all, there were chills in this room, and her wretched royal husband had died beneath this canopy.
Robert Baratheon, the first of his name. May there never be a second. A dim, drunken brute of a man. Let him weep in hell.
Taina warmed the bed as well as Robert ever had, and never tried to force Cersei's legs apart. Of late she had shared the Queen's bed more often than Lord Merryweather's. Orton did not seem to mind, or if he did, he knew better than to say so.
"I was concerned when I woke and found you gone," murmured Lady Merryweather, sitting up against the pillows, the coverlets tangled about her waist. "Is aught amiss?"
"No," said Cersei, "all is well. On the morrow Sir Loras will sail to Dragonstone to win the castle, loose the Red Wind fleet, and prove his manhood to us all." She told the Meerish woman all that had occurred beneath the shifting shadow of the Iron Throne.
"Without her valiant brother, our little queen is next to naked. Oh, she has her guards, be sure, but I have their captain here and there about the castle, a garrulous old man with a squirrel on his surcoat. Squirrels run from lions. He does not have it in him to defy the Iron Throne."
"Marjorie has other swords about her," cautioned Lady Merryweather. "She has made many friends about the court, and she and her young cousins all have admirers." "A few suitors do not concern me," Cersei said. "The army at Storm's End, however."
"What do you mean to do, Your Grace?"
"Why do you ask?"
The question was a little too pointed for Cersei's taste. "I do hope you're not thinking of sharing my idle musings with our poor little queen."
"Never. I am not that girl, Sennel."
Cersei did not care to think about Sennel. She repaid my kindness with betrayal.
Sansa Stark had done the same. So had Melara Heatherspoon and Fat Jean Farman, when the three of them were girls.
"I would never have gone into that tent if not for them. I would never have allowed Maggie the Frog to taste my morrows in a drop of blood."
"I would be very sad if you ever betrayed my trust, Taina. I would have no choice but to give you to Lord Kyburn. But I know that I should weep."
"I will never give you cause to weep, Your Grace. If I do, say the word, and I will give myself to Kyburn. I want only to be close to you,
to serve you however you require.
And for this service, what reward will you expect?
Nothing. It pleases me to please you.
Tina rolled onto her side, her olive skin shining in the candlelight. Her breasts were larger than the queen's, and tipped with huge nipples, black as horn.
She is younger than I am. Her breasts have not begun to sag.
Cersei wondered what it would feel like to kiss another woman. Not lightly on the cheek, as was common courtesy amongst the ladies of high birth, but full upon the lips. Tana's lips were very full. She wondered what it would feel like to suckle on those breasts, to lay the meerish woman on her back and push her legs apart, and use her as a man would use her, the way Robert would use her when the drink was in him, and she was unable to bring him off with hand or mouth. Those had been the worst nights, lying helpless underneath him as he took his pleasure, stinking of wine and grunting like a boar. Usually he rolled off and went to sleep as soon as it was done, and was snoring before his seed could dry upon her thighs. She was always sore afterwards, raw between the legs, her breasts painful from the mauling he would give them. The only time he'd ever made her wet was on their wedding night. Robert had been handsome enough when they first married, tall and strong and powerful, but his hair was black and heavy, thick on his chest and coarse round his sex. The wrong man came back from the Trident, the queen would sometimes think, as he was ploughing her. In the first few years, when he mounted her more often, she would close her eyes and pretend that he was Rhaegar. She could not pretend that he was Jaime. He was too different, too unfamiliar. Even the smell of him was wrong. For Robert, those nights never happened. Come morning, he remembered nothing. Or so he would have had her believe. Once during the first year of their marriage, Cersei had voiced her displeasure the next day. "You hurt me," she complained. He had the grace to look ashamed.
"It was not me, my lady," he said in a sulky, sullen tone, like a child caught stealing apple cakes from the kitchen. "It was the wine. I drink too much wine."
To wash down his admission, he reached for his horn of ale. As he raised it to his mouth, she smashed her own horn in his face so hard she chipped a tooth. Years later, at a feast, she heard him telling a servant wench how he'd cracked the tooth in a melee. "Well, our marriage was a melee," she reflected, "so he did not lie." The rest had all been lies, though. He did remember what he did to her at night. She was convinced of that. She could see it in his eyes. He only pretended to forget. It was easier to do that than face his shame. Deep down, Robert Baratheon was a coward. In time, the assaults did grow less frequent. During the first year, he took at least once a fortnight. By the end, it was not even once a year. He never stopped completely, though. Sooner or later, there would always come a night when he would drink too much and want to claim his rights. What shamed him in the light of day gave him pleasure in the darkness.
"My queen," said Tana Merryweather, "you have a strange look in your eyes. Are you unwell?"
"I was just remembering." Her throat was dry. "You are a good friend, Tina. I have not had a true friend in—" Someone hammered at the door.
Again?
The urgency of the sound made her shiver. "Have another 1,000 ships descended on us?" She slipped into a bedrobe and went to see who it was.
"Beg pardon for disturbing you, Your Grace," the guardsman said, "but Lady Stoutworth is below, begging audience."
"At this hour?" snapped Cersei. "Has Felice lost her wits? Tell her I have retired. Tell her that small folk on the shields are being slaughtered. Tell her that I have been awake for half the night. I will see her on the morrow." The guard hesitated.
"If it please Your Grace, she's not in a good way, if you take my meaning."
Cersei frowned. She had assumed Felice was here to tell her that Bronn was dead. "Very well, I shall need to dress. Take her to my cellar and have her wait." When Lady Merryweather made to rise and come with her, the queen demurred. "No, stay,"
One of us should get some rest, at least. I shan't be long. Lady Felicia's face was bruised and swollen, her eyes red from her tears. Her lower lip was broken, her clothing soiled and torn.
"'Gods be good,' Cersei said, as she ushered her into the solar and closed the door. "'What has happened to your face?'
Felice did not seem to hear the question.
"'He killed him,' she said in a quavery voice. "'Mother of mercy, he—'
She broke down sobbing, her whole body trembling. Cersei poured a cup of wine and took it to the weeping woman. "'Drink this. The wine will calm you. That's it. A little more now. Stop that weeping and tell me why you're here.' It took the rest of the flagon before the queen was finally able to coax the whole sad tale out of Lady Felice. Once she had, she did not know whether to laugh or rage.
"'Single combat?' she repeated. "'Is there no one in the Seven Kingdoms that I can rely upon? Am I the only one in Westeros with a pinch of wits? You are telling me Sir Balmain challenged Bronn to single combat?' "'He said it would be simple. "'The lance is a knight's weapon,' he said, "'and Bronn was no true knight. "'Balmain said he would unhorse him and finish him as he lay stunned.
"'Bronn was no knight. That was true. "'Bronn was a battle-hardened killer.
"'Your cretin of a husband wrote his own death warrant.
"'A splendid plan.' "'Dare I ask how it went awry?
"'Bronn drove his lance through the chest of Balmain's poor horse. "'Balmain, his legs were crushed when the beast fell. "'He screamed so piteously.'
"'Sellswords have no pity,' Cersei might have said.
"'I asked you to range a hunting mishap. "'An arrow gone astray, a fall from a horse, an angry boar. "'There are so many ways a man can die in the woods.' None of them involving lances.
Felice did not seem to hear her.
When I tried to run to my bowman, he struck me in the face. He made my lord confess. Bowman was crying out for Maester Franklin to attend him, but the sellsword, he...
Confess? Cersei did not like that word. I trust our brave Sir Bowman held his tongue.
"'Bronn put a dagger in his eye and told me I had best be gone from Stokeworth before the sun went down, or I'd get the same. "'He said he'd pass me around to the garrison if any of them would help me. "'When I ordered Bronn seized, one of his knights had the insolence to say that I should do as Lord Stokeworth said. "'He called him Lord Stokeworth.
"'Lady Felice!' clutched at the queen's hand.
"'Your grace must give me knights, 100 knights, and crossbowmen to take my castle back. Stokeworth is mine. They would not even permit me to gather up my clothes. Bronn said they were his wife's clothes now, all my silks and velvets.'
"'Your rags are the least of your concern.' The queen pulled her fingers free of the other woman's clammy grasp. "'I asked you to snuff out a candle to help protect the king. "'Instead, you heaved a pot of wildfire at it. "'Did your witless Bowman bring my name into this? "'Tell me he did not.' "'Felice licked her lips.
"'He was in pain. "'His legs were broken. "'Bronn said he would show him mercy, "'but what will happen to my poor mother?'
"'I imagine she will die.'
"'What do you think?
Lady Tanda might be dead already. "'Bronn did not seem the sort of man who would expend much effort "'nursing an old woman with a broken hip.
"'You have to help me. Where am I to go? What will I do?'
"'Perhaps you might wed Moonboy,' Cersei almost said. "'He's nigh as big a fool as your late husband. "'She cannot risk a war on the very doorstep of King's Landing, not now.' "'The Silent Sisters are always glad to welcome widows,' she said. "'Theirs is a serene life, a life of prayer and contemplation and good works. "'They bring solace to the living and peace to the dead.' "'And they do not talk.' "'She could not have the woman running about the Seven Kingdoms, spreading dangerous tales. "'Felice was deaf to good sense.
"'All we did, we did in service to your grace, proud to be faithful.' you said?
I recall. Cersei forced a smile. You shall stay here with us, my lady, until such time as we find a way to win your castle back. Let me pour you another cup of wine. It will help you sleep. You are weary and sick of heart.